I'm Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check.
Reality Check with Jeannie Allen is produced by National Review and is one of more than a dozen podcasts offered on the National Review online website. If you'd like a free subscription to the podcast so that you never miss a program, simply sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. And now, here's Jeannie Allen.
Hi, and welcome to Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. My guest today is Dr. Giselle Huff, Executive Director of the Jacqueline Hume Foundation, based in San Francisco, and a fearless advocate for students and education. Welcome, Giselle.
Thank you, Jeannie. Thank you for having me.
So one of the reasons, friends listening out there, that I couldn't wait to have Giselle, as you will hear in a few minutes, is not only does she have an absolutely fascinating life story, she is a force of nature and so committed to the importance of personalized student-centered education. She also served at one time as the chair of the Center for Education Reform, the organization that helps bring Reality Check to you. And more important, she's a dear friend who has watched so many iterations of education over the years that it's hard to fathom. We're still trying to figure out how to get it right. Giselle, after all these years of being in school, of watching schools, of supporting school efforts, what are we doing wrong?
Well, we're doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And, you know, to me, I mean, I started this out. The reason I got involved in this is because when I came to this country after the war in 1947 and I started sixth grade in the South Bronx, where I was one of three white kids in the class, the rest of the students were African American, in sixth grade, they were learning absolutely nothing in the most progressive city in the United States in 1947. And this was reiterated with the publication of A Nation at Risk in 1983. We're having the same conversations. So the reason we are having a problem with this, and it keeps recurring, is because we haven't shifted gears. We're still doing the same things.
And when you say so what looks the same? Does it look the same, sound the same? Kind of a lot of people out there are getting ready to send their kids back, you know, to school, or they're in school already, and they're like, oh, this is wonderful. That school did great for me, too. There's nostalgia everywhere. Drives me crazy. Tell us what is the same that shouldn't be.
Well, for one thing, the system that we live under, the education system we've inherited, was perfectly geared for the 20th century. It was made to find the 10 or 15 or 20% of the kids who were outstanding and were going to be leaders, and the rest of the people were perfectly fine having nice middle-class jobs where information or knowledge or the use of technology or any of the kinds of skills that are necessary for the 21st century were not necessary. So, we were a prosperous country. Everyone was doing well. Most people were doing well. And we are in exactly the same system. But the world has changed drastically.
And when you talk about that, I know that everybody's ears immediately go to, you're talking about technology. But you're not, are you?
I'm only talking about technology as a tool. Technology is not a thing unto itself. So when you're talking about personalized, data-driven instruction based on competencies, you can't do that without technology. It's a fundamental necessity, but it is not the thing. Mm-hmm. The thing is about enabling teachers and students to actually track what each child is doing and to be able to intervene when necessary and to allow kids to go at their own pace. If they're way ahead, they continue to move on. If they're way behind, everything is brought to bear to get them to move forward, to get the competencies they need in order to move forward. This is totally not what the current system does. This is something that drives me completely bananas. Is the fact that many people, I mean, when you listen to people talk about priorities in our society, education is never mentioned. And if it is, K-12 is never mentioned. It's about college. None of the challenges we face, poverty, pathologies, drug addiction, not all of those things that we're all wringing our hands around, can not be solved if we don't properly educate our children.
And when you talk about that, you talk
child.
Yes, and when you talk about it too, we've had this discussion numerous times, and you've taught me a lot. You've taught many of us a lot about it. Is you're also talking about giving students, as you just referred to before, sort of if you need to go farther, you can go farther, but also creating, constructing, right, their own environment. And you like to say knowledge is a commodity. That now you can Google stuff. It used to be you had to go to school to learn knowledge. So really school's role has changed because where knowledge is a commodity, you no longer have to deliver it, right? Talk a little bit about that approach. Are you saying that students just show up and they do whatever they want, kind of like Summerhill?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean, Summerhill was a wonderful experience for a handful of students. It's, you know, those are boutique examples like Montessori. We have to educate 55 million kids. First of all, it takes a certain kind of teacher to do that kind, to provide that kind of experience. We don't have enough of those. So really what it's about is about creating the environment where children can thrive, where they are taught from the very beginning how to take control of their own learning. And that doesn't mean doing whatever they want. Not at all. There are standards. Those don't go away. There are sequences of teaching and learning that happen, but they're based on competency acquisition, which is not knowledge. It's knowledge. Obviously, knowledge is a stuff of, but it's skills and dispositions. How do you identify, where do you find the knowledge? How do you evaluate it? How do you apply it to the problem you need to solve? And then how do you solve the problem? That's the 21st century learning experience. Learning when the Battle of Hastings was ain't going to get you nowhere.
And
so it's not an elimination of knowledge. It's a articulation of what it means to convey or to provide experiences that enable students to develop the skills and dispositions for that they need in order to use the knowledge properly in the 21st century, because the knowledge changes every day.
And that student-centered aspect of it means, for our listeners, what's the difference? So the student-centered aspect means it's dependent upon how the student evolves as part of that knowledge, what they do, how they get there, and building on skills and abilities that they have?
That's correct. And there are a number of things that go into this. When you think about the way our system works now, it's very punitive. You have a summative test at the end of the year, and then, you know, kids forget everything they learned because they memorized everything. I mean, I'm exaggerating.
Mm-hmm.
But the basis of our system, the acquisition of knowledge, is just memorizing the knowledge. Or if you are in an environment that is a little bit more advanced, then maybe it's project-based and you're able to apply the knowledge. But it's all about the teaching of knowledge, that the transfer of knowledge from the shaman, mm-hmm. you know, the teacher, the expert, to the novices. And they're supposed to absorb it and then move on, and they become the next generation of experts.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work anymore. So what we have to do is we have to allow the kids to go through the process on from their own point of view, with all the guidance they need and all the reinforcements they need in order to be allowed to fail without punishment.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, what difference does it make if it takes 5 weeks to learn fractions instead of the three that are allotted? Isn't the point that you learn fractions?
Mm-hmm.
The learning is the point. The time being the constant has got to go away. The time has to become the variable. It should, I mean, if it takes you 1 week to learn fractions, you should be allowed to go ahead. If it takes you five, you should be given the 5 weeks to learn fractions. That doesn't mean that you're not teaching fractions or that the child doesn't learn how to do fractions. Mm-hmm. No. The child does learn how to do fractions, but not in the context of this punitive, insane system we have, where you're not allowed to take more time than that is allowed.
Well, and if you're striving for competency, you can't have the teacher in the classroom in front or walking around or what have you, all these different shapes and sizes they have now, with 20 or 30 students and expecting them all to get through the material he or she is teaching in a week so you can go on to the next material. Like that,
correct.
That's the completely flawed way of doing things that may have worked at one time, you're saying, but now it's actually who, if you get there in 2 days, great, there should be something else for you to do or more material or more experiences, or perhaps you can help other people. If it takes 2 more weeks, perhaps you go into a different kind of environment or classroom or group, right? In other words, to be flexible and innovative about how students move through the education and learning process, not stuck to a 50-minute class that's expected to go from this point Monday at 8 a.m. to this point Friday at 3.
Perfectly correct. That's exactly correct. And this is why we are not seeing any progress. Since 1947, when I was with my classmates who were African-American in New York City, right, when you can go to any school in New York City in the South Bronx today and you're facing exactly the same situation. And for, you know, since the publication of A Nation at Risk,
mm-hmm.
no matter what we've done, we are flatlining because we haven't changed the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
You can change the governance like charter schools do, or you can, you know, you can allow kids to go to different kinds of schools that are not part of the establishments, like vouchers of all kinds do. But that's not, you're not changing anything fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
Those very schools are doing the very same thing.
Mm-hmm. They might get better results.
Certainly better for those kids,
right?
I mean, Kip just blew it out of the ballpark. In fact, Kip and schools like them proved 25 years ago, that those kids, in quotes, can learn
mm-hmm.
big time. Just
right.
as well, if not better than their, you know, their peers in other environments.
And what
so
you're saying is they're more flexible.
Something very important.
Right. And they're more flexible and they allow for more changes. And so more progress has been made in those schools and a lot of for those students. But across the board, 55 million students, by the way, 80 million adults that don't have a credential of any kind post-secondary who didn't finish something, right? So
correct.
The magnitude of the problem is not being addressed simply by doing something I know and love, which is providing options. It's because we're not doing new and better things internally in the actual process.
Well, it's not doing new and better things. It's literally transforming the system. Because the premises, as we were just discussing, the idea that time is the constant, that you punish kids if they don't, you know, do well on a test instead of making them realize that, you know, success is littered with failures.
Mm-hmm.
Failure is just a step towards success.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are punished all the time for failing, you lose confidence. You think you're stupid, you act out, and then you drop out. What kind of a system is that?
Right.
I mean, it's criminal to do that to children.
Yeah,
it's
criminal.
Child abuse.
Yeah.
Literally. I mean, I feel very strongly about this, you know, because I saw what happened. So many years ago, 1947.
Right. Well, and then you were...
When I came, I didn't speak English. I walked into this classroom coming from France where we were, in general, 2 years ahead of American children because the system was so rigorous there and also nationalized, right? We had a national curriculum. So everybody was in the same step, but that was back in the 40s. And I walked into, you know, the snake pit. Literally.
Right. And then just to remind our listeners, Gisele Huff, you spent a decade in the business world. You earned your PhD in political science. So we're not exactly talking to someone with a low IQ here. Political philosophy at Columbia. You taught. You were in administration at University High School, and you were a member of the board of INACO, lots of other groups, started the Learning Accelerator. You really got bitten by and influenced, I think, by Clayton Christensen, right?
Yes, yes, in 2005.
And Clayton Christensen became the head of this Institute for Disruptive Innovation. What did he say that got you so engaged?
So I met him in a small gathering before he spoke as the keynote at Education Commission of the State Conference back in 2005. And he was talking about disruptive innovation and how it applies to an industry, in quotes, like education, which it is. It's an industry. He made the same argument that he made for disruptive innovation in business. In an industry, if you don't adopt technology, you don't move forward. And if you don't challenge the status quo, if you stay and you just improve your product, you die. Mm-hmm. So essentially, he was speaking, and a lot of people have adopted the word innovation. You hear it all over the place. We had a program called Innovation to the Third Power, right? I to the Third Power as part of the Obama administration's Race to the Top.
Right.
And they invested $650 million in that. And it turns out that out of the 67 grantees in the first tranche, 53 did nothing. 9 actually moved the needle. They just did an evaluation. So, doing the same thing over and over again doesn't change anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that lesson I learned from Clay. You cannot make your new and improved RCA system better and expect to stay on top of the industry when Sony is coming down with is coming at you with the transistor radio.
Right.
Because your customers number in the hundreds of thousands and theirs number in the millions and millions.
So
and eventually, vacuum tubes disappear and transistors become, it become the digital age.
So who's our education transistor today? Who's your model?
So, there's a handful of organizations whose mission is exclusively, a number of organizations like yours, have a small tranche of stuff that you do that's around this space, innovation. But it's not disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a handful of organizations that are doing this at a national level. There are a lot of districts that are actually doing this, that are implementing this in their own, in their own space. With great difficulty because they have to go against the tide. But we have Bob Wise, who runs the Alliance for Excellent Education, has 3,000 district leaders who are signed up to future-ready schools, and probably about 1,000 that are really active. And out of those, there may be a couple, maybe 400 or 500, who are actually implementing this kind of learning in their districts, little by little, sometimes one class at a time, sometimes one school at a time, sometimes a grade across schools at a time. Everybody has a different way of doing it. But it's definitely happening. By the way, it's happening more in districts than it is in charter schools.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Charter schools that were created to be that, like Summit Public Schools, which is a charter school chain on the West Coast, and that is now promulgating this model by, offering training to anybody who qualifies. They're the only ones that are really doing this. The old line charters,
right,
who have a formula that works very well for their kids, They're not particularly interested.
Well, thank that punitive top-down accountability that some of the very people in charter school organizations created. It stifled risk. It stifled innovation. They wanted to,
correct.
You know, when I look at some applications today and they, the reviewers come back and say, oh, where's your justification for class size? What? This isn't about class size. Or how do you know that your program is going to work? Well, you know what? If most of what we were doing today was known before, then there would be nothing new, right?
That's correct.
It's insane.
It is insane. I say that every third sentence when I speak to people about this. We are literally in a world of Looney Tunes.
You know,
it goes against everything we need for our kids and as a nation.
No, there's no question. And I'm super excited that you are going to have an even better, more expanded conversation like this with Governor Jeb Bush, formerly of Florida, former presidential candidate at the CER 25th Anniversary Summit, The Road to Innovation. And we really want to highlight the kind of innovations you're talking about and push people to think differently about learning, about the experience from K through career, by the way. It has to be everywhere. So for those listeners out there who don't have it on their calendar yet, make sure that you go quickly to edreform.com and sign up. You'll be able to meet and see Giselle there. Giselle, final question for you, kind of off the topic. You've shared with me that one of your other pursuits is to change the way philanthropy works. It's a big topic. You're executive director of a major league foundation, the Jacqueline Hume Foundation, has done so much for so many. You've had exposure to lots of philanthropists. Why does it need to change?
So I've been at this 20 years, and when I first started, philanthropy was counting, okay? So if you had a program that had 100 people go through it, and then the next year they had 200 people go through it, they asked for twice as much money. Nobody ever asked, well, when they go through the program, does it work for them? It just was all numbers. I mean, it was completely. So they started to change, and they became more, philanthropy did, became more interested in, you know, what the results were. But the net, right now what is happening is that they don't take risks. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, tax-free money that is completely at the discretion of the boards of these philanthropies should be, a good part of it should be going into throwing spaghetti at the wall, acting like VCs, finding the 10-15% of organizations that are doing way out there things that have the potential of transforming, and helping them along until such time as they proved it doesn't work. But out of those, just like VCs, right, when in the VCs in Silicon Valley, they make investments that peter out. But they also make investments that become PayPal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazon,
mm-hmm.
Google, Facebook, right? Absolutely transformative efforts.
Mm-hmm.
Those were people like, you know, Reed Hastings and Peter Thiel who made investments in these organizations, now became multi-billionaires because of it. That's besides the point. But they were VCs. They saw something, and I'm sure they invested in 10 other things at the same time that you never heard of because you never will.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, part of the amount of money that foundations are sitting on, these amounts of money are discretionary. They only have to spend 5% of their money each year of their corpus, which includes expenses, by the way, not 5% in grant making, 5% that includes expenses. So the cost of doing business, including taking your staff to a retreat in Cabo San Lucas, right? So they've spent 5%, and out of that, I can't even put a number on. It's so small on the risks that they take.
No, and in fact, quite to the contrary, they expect you to tell them that everything was a success, or you won't get funded again. And so people guard guard the truth sometimes, frankly. They don't tell everything that went wrong in the way because you're afraid that you'll be told, it didn't work, I don't want to do it again. And you're right, being able to, daring to dream, it's what this nation's about. It's what we should and have sometimes taught in education, to be entrepreneurial, to be risk-taking. That's how you find the innovations. That's how you help people spur decisions. It's a great conquest for you to take on.
Yes.
I am super excited to talk with you about that in the future as well. But I'm so thrilled that you spent this time with us, Giselle. It's been such a pleasure talking to you on this edition of Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. Thanks for listening. Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced by National Review and posted on Monday at nationalreview.com. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free and make sure you don't miss any future programs. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And you can also find much more about education reform, opportunity, and innovation at the Center for Education Reform's website, edreform.com. Don't forget, tune in to Reality Check every week.